From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Corlott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis join me to discuss international holiday traditions, the impact of holiday shopping, and how economies have fared around the world during 2014.
Most of the prognosticators say it's going to continue to grow, but with turbulence next year, but they don't expect it to grow more than 7 or 8%.
Then I'll talk with Paula Allen. She traveled to Chile in 1989 to cover the end of Pinochet's dictatorship, but passion drew her to tell the stories of Chilean women who spent 17 years searching for the remains of their executed family members.
Sometimes I'm a photojournalist, sometimes I'm a human rights photographer, and I would say basically that I'm an activist. I use a camera because that's what gives voice to what I care about in the world.
Documenting the hidden struggles of women across the globe. But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlott. Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis, Merry Christmas. We've just celebrated the holiday, and it's always a good time, interesting time at this time of the year to think about and compare how holiday celebrations come off around the world. But rather than talking about Christmas necessarily, let's talk about something interesting called Boxing Day.
What is Boxing Day?
That's what I mean. We need to know what Boxing Day is, right? So it's traditionally celebrated the day after Christmas, and largely in the UK and Commonwealth countries, former British colonies. But it was the day after Christmas when servants and tradespeople would receive a Christmas box from employers that would have food and gifts and Christmas bonuses. So they received this box, and it came to be known as Boxing Day. Now, in South Africa, they've changed it to a day of goodwill. In other parts of the world, Germany, Poland, you know, other Scandinavian countries, for example, it's second Christmas Day, which is very different from Boxing Day. So, Rebecca, tell us, make these distinctions for us between what goes on the day after Christmas in much of the world.
Let me start with the one that you talked about second, the second day of Christmas, this idea that we not only have Christmas Eve, but Christmas Day and then another day. And the countries that you mentioned, Germany and others, this is a day for quiet and rest, whereas on Christmas Eve, you probably are with family exchanging gifts. Christmas Day, Santa Claus, or the fact, whatever Santa Claus is in that country, the Father Christmas, Father Winter, will come and you'll be with family. And then on the second day, it's a time for personal reflection, to kind of think about where you are in life, where you're going, think about family and what's important. But as you mentioned, Boxing Day is something really quite different. And I think that the idea of boxing, while you're correct that it comes from this idea of the servant's box, it really does seem apropos in what Boxing Day has turned into in two ways. It becomes a huge shopping day. So perhaps we can think of our custom of Black Friday and Thanksgiving, where people are literally boxing to get the best deal in the store. It's also a huge sporting day. So, for example, like on New Year's Day here, where we watch a great deal of football, or again on Thanksgiving. So that's really what's going on that day. So some countries, it's quiet and it's rest. And then in other countries, the UK and former or the Commonwealth countries, it's a lot of activity outside, watching sporting events or shopping for the best deals.
Watching sporting events, engaging in hunting, even. Hunting is a big part of Boxing Day as well. But shopping is really what you see if you go to London or any of these places where they really celebrate Boxing Day. It is a madhouse. Everybody out shopping, returning. You know, we tend to think of it here in the United States as a place, as a time when you return your Christmas gifts, those that you don't want. But there, it's really, it is the equivalent of the Black Friday. It's the biggest shopping day of the year. And so the impact that that has on the economy is substantial. We talk about how, you know, how Black Friday and all of the days leading up to holidays are really critical for the American economy, for the U.S. economy. And the same is true in the UK and elsewhere that experience this Boxing Day. And that is, it's a day to consume. It's a day to engage in activities where money is generated and the economy picks up. So what have you found, Rebecca, in terms of the impact of Boxing Day on economic activity?
Well, we'll see how it goes this year. But if we look at numbers from last year, for December 26, 2013, £2.2 billion was spent in stores in Great Britain. And about £300 million, a little bit more than that, £300 million spent online during that day. And that was just the 26th. This tends to be kind of a 3 or 4 day period of time, but the most goods are purchased on the 26th. So that is substantial. Now, we might think this might be citizens in London or elsewhere, and that certainly is the case. But the biggest consumers are actually people that fly in specifically to buy goods. And these people tend to come overwhelmingly from China, from UAE and other Gulf countries, and they come in and spend thousands upon thousands of dollars. So it is incredibly important to the economy there. Now, something that's changed slightly, and this is perhaps due to other factors, and Amazon was really spearheading this, is that in Great Britain, they're now starting to celebrate Black Friday. So they're starting to see sales happening after what would be Thanksgiving, our Thanksgiving, but on that date there. And then you're starting to see a lot more pre-sales. So people are starting to buy a little bit earlier, and there is some concern that in years to come, we might see less purchases on Boxing Day because people will be a little burnt out with all the earlier purchases that they've made.
Well, even though we're focusing on kind of the end of the year economic situation, Joshua, it's been an interesting economic year around the world in terms of
those Boxing Day sales will have to be very big to pull Europe out of its languishing economy. And this year has been a great year for America to continue its growth, 2.2% growth. But next year, we're expecting 3.1% accelerated growth in both U.S. and India. China growth has plateaued, Europe languished, and Japan has really swooned. Inflation fell everywhere thanks to oil prices going down. But the stock market has been on a tear in the United States, 14% up this year. But last year was 32%. So it's really been an incredible bull market. People are expecting – most of the prognosticators say it's going to continue to grow but with turbulence next year. But they don't expect it to grow more than 7 or 8%. But the stock market has tripled since 2009, its low. And this was the best year for jobs since 1999 in the United States. But there are some dark clouds out there on the horizon, and that's that corporate earnings are not up to match the stock market. China has sort of plateaued the housing market crisis there. It's still growing at 7% though. So it's
plateauing at 7%.
But it is
too bad.
It is pulling the world behind it. But Europe looks like it could go into a recession, and Japan is. So
how do oil prices affect all this though, Joshua?
That could give a big boost, and inflation has been down, but inflation could pick up in the future, and clearly the Fed has already indicated that by June or this summer they may begin to raise prices. But so far, you know, it looks good for the American economy. Obviously, the oil people, and that means Oklahoma and Texas, unfortunately, are going to take a hit from this oil prices. But consumers
are, this is great for consumers.
It's great for consumers.
The cost of oil is down for them. Cost of gasoline is down, and providing them that extra.
And that's why sales for Christmas.
For purchasing.
That's why sales this Christmas seem to be going very well, because people do feel positive about the coming year and prospects.
Well, this does say something about one's confidence in your economy. The question is how long that confidence will continue. But nonetheless, happy holidays to you and everyone out there listening. Thank you so much, Joshua and Rebecca, for being with me today on World.
Well, thank you, and I'll be waiting for that box tomorrow.
It's coming. It's in the mail. Happy holidays. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation or answer any questions you might have. You can leave your comments online at kgou.org or on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU, at Suzette Corlott, at Joshua_Landis, and at Cruise226. After a short break, I'm joined by Paula Allen. She's a photojournalist and documentary photographer who spent the past 25 years telling the stories of women whose family members were disappeared and executed during the early days of Chile's coup and subsequent dictatorship in the early 1970s. I'm Suzette Gorelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelot. Today I'm joined by Paula Allen. 25 years ago, she walked into one of the most brutal deserts in the world on Christmas Day with several Chilean women who spread hundreds of red carnations across the sand in memory of their husbands and sons. The 26 men were executed in 1973 and buried in a secret grave near the city of Calama. The women finally found the remains in 1990, and Paula Allen has spent the past quarter century telling their stories through photos. Paula Allen, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. I'm so pleased to be here.
You are a documentary photographer, so you travel around the world. You've been to some amazing places documenting certain experiences that are happening there on the ground and showing those images to us. And so, you know, first I'd kind of like just to begin with that, your work as a photographer. I mean, you teach a class in New York, Why am I a photojournalist? And so, you know, from photojournalism to documenting certain experiences on the ground, can you just kind of tell us a little bit about the background of that and the importance of documenting things in images, not in film, but in photography?
You know, I was thinking, I did teach a class at the International Center of Photography, Why Am I a Photojournalist? And I think I asked that question to my students because it's a question that I repeatedly ask to myself. Sometimes I'm a photojournalist, sometimes I'm a human rights photographer, sometimes I'm a documentary photographer, and I would say basically that I'm an activist. And I use a camera because that's what gives voice to what I care about in the world. So that's why I chose a camera, because it works for me. It's the most effective vehicle I have to communicate what I think needs to be communicated. I have traveled all over the world, and I'm led by many ways into the world. I'm led by situations that are unfolding, and I go to find them, which is where I began with nonviolent revolutions in the world. And then I continued by going into war to understand what that meant, how to affect war with the camera, how to change it, how to raise consciousness. And from that, I went into documenting more about violence and sexual violence against women specifically, because I felt as a woman, as a subject matter that wasn't being talked about very much, that I had an obligation, a responsibility, and a desire to pursue that as subject for my work.
Well, you clearly have focused on, as you mentioned, issues regarding human rights and war and violence, conflict, abuse, injustice. I mean, this is definitely a theme in your work. I like how you put it, that you want to see how using that camera, going into these places, can have an impact on the situation. And so maybe you can extend this a little bit and just tell us, I mean, I want to get into some specific places you've been here in a minute, but just in general, what is it that you hope people will take away just by seeing those images? What is the impact that you're hoping to have?
I think that in being here at the university, I can answer that question more specifically to being here, is that I hope that people come away with understanding who they are and what they want to be doing and how they can best connect with the world and how they can take the feelings that are generated from the images and apply it to their own lives and their own activism and a kind of connection relationship that they will continue with their own lives. So I think I'm asking the viewer of images to identify more with who they are and with themselves, so then they can then take action for themselves.
So tell us about that difficulty of being in that situation and seeing these things. I mean, for those of us who are viewing these images, we often think how tough that must be to actually be. It's hard enough to see them on a printed page, but you know, or on a digital screen. But to see them in real life and the impact that that must have on you as you are drawn to these things, as you are drawn to trying to have an impact on a particular situation. So wherever it is that you've been, you've seen some very difficult things. And so how has that affected you in your work and motivated you more or, you know, influenced what it is that you support or whatever?
Look, there is no doubt that it is emotionally very, very hard to do this work. I get asked very often, how, you're in such physical danger, and how do you do what you do, and aren't you afraid? And I always comment that, yes, there's physical danger, but I have an awareness of that, and I go in knowing that. And what the greatest danger is, the emotional danger. But the point is that of it is that no matter what that is, I do it because I feel capable of doing it. And I want to do it. And I also think that I get to leave. You know, I have the privilege, the deep privilege of being able to go into any situation in the world, and then I can get on a plane and I can leave and I can go back to a more safe, if there is such a thing as a safe zone in the world, and leave behind the violence that I'm witnessing. So it's hard to answer that besides saying that I can manage the emotions. I want to manage them because my responsibility is to share that experience, and my gratitude exists to where I've been and the people who have permitted me to enter into their lives in such a profound way to tell their stories. So the obligation, the responsibility to share the stories is far greater than anything personally that I'm experiencing.
That's my guest, Paula Allen, who spent her career as a documentary photographer telling the stories of European nuclear disarmament, nonviolent revolutions, and human rights atrocities on four continents. We'll talk specifically about her work with Chilean women in the city of Calama right after this break. I'm Suzette Gourlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gourlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My guest today is Paula Allen, a photojournalist and activist who spent 3 decades documenting Chechen refugees, the 1995 Srebrenica massacre, and the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. When we left off, she described how the emotional toll is the greatest danger of telling these stories, but she feels an obligation and a responsibility that overshadows how the work may affect her. Well, I think the fact that you use the word responsibility is very interesting, because in reading a lot of the work that's been done about you and your photography indicates that as you're telling your story, you're saying, I heard that this was happening in Kosovo or in Chile or in the Congo or wherever, and I had to go and see it myself, and I had to document it. I had to tell that story. So this sense of responsibility that you have, that you're drawn to these places. But so tell us about these places. Tell us about some of these places you've been. I know you were in Srebrenica, for example, after the massacre there in the 90s. You've been to Kosovo. The reason why you're here at the University of Oklahoma right now is because of the work that you've done in Chile for many years with women searching for their loved ones who were disappeared and murdered and have never returned, and their search for their remains and for answers. So, you know, there's a theme here. You're drawn to war and conflict, but particularly where women are affected and women are involved. So tell us about the places you've been and the ways in which you've been affected.
I think what I would like to answer that is to tell the story about the women of Calama. Briefly, 26 men were disappeared and executed after the 1973 coup in Chile, where Salvador Allende, the democratically elected president, was overthrown and by Pinochet and by the U.S. government, who backed the coup. And 26 of the men were killed, and the women were never given back the bodies in this town in the far north of Chile. And they searched for 17 years for a mass grave. And they finally found a mass grave in 1990, and they found the remains of their men. And I arrived 25 years ago, right before they found the remains, and I have been documenting them for all those years. How do you get someplace in the world is really the question. How do we find ourselves where we are? I got to them because I was on my way to Chile to photograph the transition of power between Pinochet and the next president, Patricio Aylwin, on an assignment for Newsweek magazine. And I got a phone call from a friend the night before I was leaving who said, I've just seen a film called Dance of Hope, and there's a scene in the film that shows these women in a desert town in Chile throwing carnations into the air, and the flowers are landing all over the desert floor because they never knew where their men were buried. Their men were executed and disappeared. Hearing that image, I knew that I had to go. So I contacted the filmmaker, Deborah Schaefer. She sent me the film. I took a copy of the film to Chile with me. I completed my assignment for Newsweek in Santiago. I boarded a 26-hour grueling bus ride to the north of Chile with the film in my hand from Deborah Schaefer, and I met the women. So That is how I arrived in Calama. I didn't speak Spanish. I'm not Chilean. I have no relationship, presumably, to Chile. But I was drawn there by one image that was in a film. And I knew, as a woman who was committed to documenting really the hidden struggles of women all over the world, I needed to be there.
So you mentioned the role of the women in this case and the incredible strength that obviously you've witnessed among these women, the resilience of these women. I think one of the common themes, it seems to me, in the work that you've done is that you're drawn to these issues of women in these horrible situations, you know, that are experiencing war and violence and rape and genocide and all of these things. But that the ultimate message is one of resilience and power and healing. I mean, is this part of the message that you're trying to show? Is here are the horrible things that happen, but here are the amazing ways in which these women around the world overcome these things? I mean, that just it's almost like a mixed message in some ways, but it comes through to me in that way. I don't know if that's what you're intending.
Isn't life a great contradiction? Really, you know, you go into the what would be the worst situations in the world, and I don't even know what that means anymore. Like, I go, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. And then a month later, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. And it goes on and on and on and on. And what happens in those worst situations are you meet the best people. Over and over again, you meet the people who are fighting the dictatorship, who are fighting the violence, who are refusing to be silenced, to maintain their dignity in the face of tragedy, over and over again. So we talk about being in the middle of the greatest pain in the world, and there's always someone, people, who have the greatest spirit and the greatest fortitude and the greatest courage in the face of those situations.
So great lessons to learn, you know, from tragic events is how to persevere, I guess, in these situations. It's sad but true, like you said, a major contradiction. Well, Paula Allen, thank you so much for being here with us on Worldviews today to share these images with us from around the world. Thank you.
Thank you. I feel very fortunate to have been here today.
You've been listening to my conversation with Paula Allen, a documentary photographer and self-described activist. You can see some of her images of the women in Calama on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews as a collaborative partnership with the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Our research fellow is Symphony Swift, and our producer and digital editor is Brian Hardzinski. For Joshua Landis and Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Rolat.